Two pilots whose jet was shot down by Syria about 2 weeks ago. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan attended the funeral at an airbase in the southern city of Malatya from where the pilot's plane had departed. Religious ceremonies are expected throughout the day in that country. Turkey denies Syrian claims that the jet was shot down inside Syrian airspace. The incident has raised tensions in the region as many Syrians continue to seek refuge in Turkey from the more than year-old uprising in their own country. We're seeing U.S. stocks trading lower. At last glance, the Dow is off nearly 190 points at 12,708. NASDAQ off more than 1.5% at 2,926. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace J. Cameron Living Trust, providing support to NPR and to member station KMBH serving the Rio Grande Valley.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to visit the Promenade Gift Shop for artfully affordable and exceptionally eclectic gifts. More information on upcoming events is at KrannertCenter.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
A plane crashes, a bridge collapses, and our first impulse is to blame design. Our guest this morning, Henry Petroski, who's professor of civil engineering and history at Duke University, he's been studying catastrophic failures like these for a long time. And he says, while there may indeed, in some cases, be design issues, there is always a human element to be considered. He says, in fact, you have to take into consideration that we're talking here about systems, and that they are systems that include people who sometimes make mistakes, mistakes that can range from basic carelessness to outright fraud. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Henry Petroski about some of the ideas that you'll find in a recently published book that he has authored. The title of his book is To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure, and it's published by Belknap, Harvard. It has just recently come out. And I do also want to mention that our guest got his PhD here at the University of Illinois, PhD in Theoretical and Applied Mechanics in 1968. So we're very pleased to have him here. Professor Petroski, thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me to come.
Well, tell me about any particular memories about Urbana that stand out in your mind from when you were here as a grad student?
Well, I remember it getting very cold in the winter and very windy with the wind coming off the plains. I didn't have a car when I was in Urbana, so I did a lot of walking. I have firsthand experience of all this.
All right. Well, you wrote a book titled To Engineer Is Human, which was about mechanical and structural failures. And this book, in a sense, is something of a companion, or at least people will see that you're playing on the old saying about human failure and divine forgiveness, that to engineer is human, but to forgive design. So tell me a little bit how you see these two books and the two sets of ideas going together.
Well, the first book, while I was writing it, had the working title of What is Engineering? I was really trying to understand it myself because at that time I had 3 degrees in engineering. I had worked as an engineer. I had taught engineering. I was registered as a professional engineer. But when some of my colleagues who were not engineers asked me, what is this that engineering does? What do you do? What do engineers do? Why is it that engineers are responsible for so many failures and mistakes? And I didn't have a ready answer. I had to think about it. And the way I think best is by writing. So I decided I'd try to write a book explaining what is engineering. And it ended up being the book To Engineer Is Human, which talks a lot about failure because the conclusion I came to, and I still believe it's valid, is that understanding failure is at the heart of engineering. What engineers want to do first and foremost is prevent failure, keep it from happening. In order to do that, they have to think rather explicitly about what could fail in a machine or a system. Now, that book was published in 1985, and I've continued to reflect upon the idea of failure in design and engineering ever since, in part because accidents, failures, continue to happen. I wrote that book before the Challenger explosion, for example, certainly before some of the famous bridge collapses like the one in Minneapolis about 5 years ago now. So this new book really explores some of these more recent failures, for one, but also, as you said in your introduction, I look at engineered systems rather than just engineered objects or machines or devices. So it's about incorporating the human element in a much more explicit way than I did in the first book.
Well, you know, when one thinks about it, it would seem that we have been building things for such a long time. Say a bridge, for example, human beings have been building bridges for a very long time, that you would have had the opportunity to study a lot of designs to understand why things go wrong. Now we have the advantage of being able to apply computers to this whole process. So one might ask, given all of that experience and the history of this technology, why it is now at this point in the, when we're into the 21st century, why anything should fail? Why we shouldn't be able to design something that won't fail?
Well, that's a very good question and a very fair question. The fact of the matter is that it's true that we've been building bridges for millennia. But what's different about the bridges we're building today, at least some of them, is that they're longer. We try to make them more economical. We try to use new materials. In other words, we're always exploring with new technologies, new stretches of technology. And when we do this, we sometimes are going into regions of understanding that are not complete. The fact of the matter is also that when we experience failures, these are wake-up calls. And clearly, they beg for our understanding what did happen, so we don't repeat that mistake. But the other side of the coin is that when we do get things figured out or think we have them figured out, and we continue to build longer and longer bridges, for example, we develop a certain sense of confidence that tends to go into overconfidence. And as a result, what we subsequently design and build, we pay less and less attention to the fact that we might not have a full understanding. We believe we do have a full understanding, but time and time again, it's shown that we don't. So there is this sort of a cycle to success and failure. Following prolonged periods of success, there seem to be inevitable failures that occur because we forget the lessons of the past and we think that we finally got it figured out. But when a failure does occur, it's a wake-up call, and it clearly is something that begs for explanation.
Mm-hmm. I am sure that I would expect that any designer or any engineer it would make something, and that if you ask them, truly, is this thing perfect? Do you see any possibility that there might be a failure? I would expect that person would say, well, of course, nothing is perfect. There always is possibility of failure. But that gets to this question of how good are we at calculating the probability that something might fail? And do we, in fact, have a bit of a bias to, let us say, underestimate the odds of something failing?
No, we've gotten quite good at estimating the odds of something failing, the probability of failure occurring. But there's a funny thing about probability, and that is, let's say the probability of something happening we calculate to be 1 in a million. Mm-hmm. What that number doesn't tell us, what that probability calculation doesn't tell us, is when that one is going to occur. It could occur on the first time we try the thing, such as happened with the Titanic, for example. On its maiden voyage, it hit the iceberg and sunk. That wasn't a surprise to anybody that if you hit an iceberg, you might sink. But we sometimes gain an overconfidence by a very remote possibility of something happening. That's not really rational or logical. We're playing the odds. And this usually works quite well, but when the odds are that the bad event comes up sooner than expected, although not rationally sooner than expected, we are taken by surprise.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe we could talk a little bit about the Titanic. You certainly do in the book, and it might still be on people's minds as we have just relatively recently passed the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the ship. When you talk about systems and ways that that humans are involved that can lead to failure, here we have a wonderful coming together of potential design flaws, maybe also a bit of a case of hubris if you tell yourself that something can't fail, and then humans, in the way that they operate the device, if we're talking about something, you know, like a complex machine like this, this was a case where it seemed that all of these things really came together, and perhaps in a way that would not have been foreseen.
Well, I would only say that I think that in retrospect, they should have all been foreseeable, mm-hmm. what happened to the Titanic. Mm-hmm. Because it was known that it was going to sail through the North Atlantic, where there were icebergs, especially at the time of the year when it was going to be there. So the possibility of the Titanic hitting an iceberg was very real, and nobody could have said it was zero. So that possibility was clearly present, and then engineers have to think, well, what happens if it hits the iceberg? Well, one way that designers, naval architects, could guard against that was by making a rather strong hull, for example. Then they could say, well, you know, no matter how strong we make something, there could be a collision that's harder, you know, than the hull can absorb. In which case, we have to take the next step and say, so it's possible that some water will come into the hull. Well, what do we do then? Well, the thinking of engineers is, well, we want to contain that water, so we design bulkheads into the ship. The Titanic had bulkheads to compartmentalize any accident. Unfortunately, the bulkheads only went so high, which meant that if water came in and if the bow started to dip into the sea because the water was pulling it down, then the water would spill over the bulkheads. And this is exactly what appears to have happened. So the water went further and further back into the ship, and the ship took on more and more water, and eventually sank. Now, in the book, I speculate or conduct a thought experiment, if you will. Imagine that the Titanic had not hit the iceberg. After all, the chances of it hitting an iceberg were probabilities. It didn't necessarily have to happen. If the ship had been going more slowly, or if everybody was paying more attention and sighted an iceberg, let's say the iceberg, far enough in advance, the ship could have avoided it, in which case it might have gotten to New York successfully, in which case the claims of it having been a unsinkable ship would have been proven, in quotes. And let's imagine further that the Titanic then went back and forth between New York and London or Southampton many, many times. Well, what would be the consequences of that successful Titanic? Well, competing steamship companies would certainly have said, well, you know, we're losing business to this Titanic. We've got to do something. What can we do? Well, we can build larger ships. We can build faster ships. We'd like to have a bigger profit margin, so maybe we can build them for less money. How do we do that? Well, maybe we can make their hulls thinner and so forth, and even to the point where, well, you know, if the Titanic is such a great design and it's not sinkable, and we're copying the Titanic, only making our ships a little bigger, a little faster, maybe we don't need any lifeboats at all. After all, if we're not going to have any accidents, we don't need to save people. Well, so the logic then becomes one that really drives the inevitable failure, because the odds are that one of those ships eventually would hit an iceberg, and it would have been even more vulnerable than the Titanic. So success and failure are very closely interrelated, and depending on whether a given system succeeds or fails depends on how others that are in the same business, let's say, in the same design business, how they react to it.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Henry Petrosky. He is a professor of civil engineering and also of history at Duke University, and he's very interested in why things fail. So we're talking about large machines, perhaps, like the Titanic or bridges, and he's written on this in his book, To Engineer is Human, The Role of Failure in Successful Design. That was published in 1985, and he has a new one that is titled To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. This is just out. It's published by Belknap Press, Harvard University Press. He's written a number of books, including some very interesting books about the design of common everyday objects like the toothpick and the pencil. And if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. You also may write to us by email if you would like to do that. And the address there is will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have a caller here to talk with, and let us do that. And it's someone, I believe, in Champaign County to start us off. Line number one. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
End of an era, indeed. I was talking about the Challenger era, of course, and the first disaster, people remember Feynman on the commission, perhaps, putting the rubber O-rings or whatever they were into ice water and showing how brittle they were. There's not a lot of, still not a lot of people pointing out that the teacher in space metaphor was used in Reagan's address. There was pressure to make sure the launch happened, but that's aside. But I wanted to talk about the other part of the design of the Challenger, and it had to do with the military-industrial complex and the upsizing of the vehicle that was controversial, and there still hasn't been a whole lot of discussion on that either. You don't really need to shoot your cargo up with your... if you're working in space, if you're doing rapid deployment, which was what the military sort of fantasized about, the reason it was just pushing the edges of possibilities and materials was because it had been upsized. And I don't know whether you know the story, agree with that analysis, but since you did mention the Challenger at the beginning, I thought I'd get those points out and elicit a comment or your analysis. Thanks.
Well, yes, I do talk about the space shuttle program in the book and the Challenger in particular. The Challenger didn't have to fail. The story is well known that the engineers who were closest to the design and understood the design, including that of the O-rings, warned that it was too cold that morning to really be assured of a safe launch. The managers, however, overruled the engineers, and in part for the point you make that President Reagan was hoping to acknowledge the teacher in space during, I think it was his State of the Union address. Now, it's interesting to note that before the space shuttle was launched, the first one was even launched, engineers were asked, well, what's the odds of an accident happening that would basically kill the astronauts? And the engineers said, well, from what we know of the system and its design, maybe 1 in 100. Well, those aren't very long odds. The managers were also asked that question, and their estimate was 1 in 100,000. Well, that's quite different. Engineers and managers have different objectives and see the same system in the same circumstances in quite different ways. There were 24 successful launches of the shuttle and returns from space before the Challenger launch, and some of those, in fact, most of those had little problems. The O-rings were leaking in some. In others, the tiles were coming off. There are usually precursors to accidents, but being human, being people, we tend to want to be optimistic, and even sometimes engineers fall into this trap. So the Challenger, had it been an earlier launch, say the third or the fourth, probably would not have gone, because people hadn't had the experience that O-rings, even though they were leaking a little bit, didn't prevent a successful return. So those the positive experience, the successes, if you will, albeit limited successes, emboldened the people, especially the managers. The Challenger failure, of course, shut down the program. What was it, for a couple of years? Mm. And that was a typical reaction to failure. And it was actually pointed out that NASA had a culture that was really not quite as good as it should be regarding how it looked at potential failures and potential accidents. Well, of course, the shuttle program returned and shuttles flew again. But then the Columbia happened in 2003. That was about the 110th or 12th launch, if I recall correctly. And there were warning signs before that happened. The foam that was being shed from the, I guess it was the external tank, had been happening with, you know, regularity. But generally, it was rationalized that, well, these light pieces of foam aren't going to really do that much damage. But on the launch of the Columbia, the piece of foam hit with such velocity, such a vulnerable part of the fore edge of the wing of the shuttle, that it did compromise the vehicle's integrity to be able to return to Earth in the heat of reentry. And of course, we know what happened. So the shuttle program over the course of its lifetime is another good example, I think, of how we go through these cycles of success and failure, and largely for human psychological reasons rather than technical reasons.
All right. I appreciate the comment of the caller. We have someone else here. They're in Piatone. We'll go there next to our line four. Hello.
Hey, good morning. I grew up with that whole shuttle program. It was made and built where I was and shipped out to Edwards where I grew up. I lived in Lancaster, and pretty much anybody that we grew up with worked on it, including myself. Now, part of the problem is, and I know people like to complain a lot about shuttle and how waste of money it is, and sure, everything that we do out there when it's first developed as a prototype is going to be a problem child. And people have to look back in history, the X-15, all the lifting bodies, everything that we've basically built out at Edwards is tested and proven out at Edwards has been a failure in the beginning and started out to be, you know, something more significant afterwards. It's part of the same thing with cars. The Volt is having a problem now. Everything that man does, man is not perfect. And as long as we're not perfect, we don't make perfect things until we refine them. And what I guess my big thing is I'm a NASA advocate. Now, I think what this country is doing now is letting the private industry do this, and I think it's a smart idea. I think, because it's our tax dollars and we're spending. The bottom line is the ingenuity, the engineers are not there like they used to be. My father-in-law is a retired NASA engineer who did work on the shuttle for years. And I think our space program is the safest in the world. People need to start looking at other countries and what they did or didn't do and how they reacted to their situations. Granted, like you said, there were mistakes and they should not have gone forward, and that's been proven, but you're going to get that in everything. And people need to start being smart about what, you know, how we do it. It's going to happen. You're going to have accidents. I don't know. I think the way the American psyche is now, they want to have something that's not going to blow up and not have problems. That's impossible. That's never been done in history. But I'm kind of curious to see what you say. And thanks.
Okay.
Well, yes, you make some good points. I certainly agree that when you are exploring new technology, you have to expect that things are going to go wrong at the beginning, because generally speaking, if you're really doing something new, you don't fully understand the new regimes you're moving into. That's precisely what makes it new. I discuss this in my book, and I basically say that if we don't want to have accidents, then we really don't want innovation. We don't want to move ahead. We don't want to explore advances in technology. We have choices to make, but we do have to understand exactly what you pointed out, that if we are going to try to advance technology, we have to appreciate that there will be accidents. We try as best we can to anticipate them and keep them from happening. But as you say, we're humans, and that means the designs that we humans create are as flawed as we are.
Well, let me ask you this, because engineers work for clients, so it might be a private client, and maybe you're designing a giant steamship, or maybe it's a government and you're designing a bridge or some kind of public structure. For the people that you're working for, cost is always going to be a bottom line, and they will have a budget and they will insist on keeping to it. How many problems do you think of the kind that we're talking about, though, may be traced back to the fact that someone has decided you can only spend so much money and that places constraints on design?
Well, that's true. That is a constraint. Cost is almost always a constraint with engineering projects. The engineer and the client should both understand that they are going to have to compromise. The question is, do you want to compromise safety? There are other things you can compromise. You can compromise features that are not essential to safety, for example. So the dialogue should proceed in a rational way, and cost alone should not necessarily mean that there are going to be accidents. One 19th century definition of engineering was, and it's a hyperbole, of course, and it had to do with laying out railroads, was that anybody, the quote actually says, any fool can design something for $2, but an engineer can design it for $1, implying that the engineer, given the engineer's experience and talent and knowledge, should be able to do things without spending excess amounts of money.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Henry Petroski. He's a professor of civil engineering and history at Duke University. He's the author of a number of books about design. His most recent is To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. Is the title. It's published by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. And looks, among other things, looks at the fact that devices, machines, big constructions are made by humans, they're used by humans, and when they fail, you've got to take into account the human element in all of that. And questions are welcome. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have some other callers here, and we'll proceed here to the next. Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I wonder if your guest talked about the original Twin Towers in terms of failures. I remember when the incident first happened and the buildings burned for a certain amount of time and then they fell, there was this uproar that went up. You know, how could these towers fall? And at one point in one of the news broadcasts, someone said, well, they brought in the engineer who had designed it. And he said, well, it really didn't fail because I designed it to burn for a certain amount of time before the buildings would collapse. But it's just to say, I'm just wondering whether that's part of what you're thinking about when you talk about failures, because in a way, the Twin Towers really didn't fail. It did what he had designed it to do, and you know, yet he was severely criticized for the design.
Well, yes, that's a very interesting point. It's a matter of how you define failure. Engineers always design their systems, whether they be buildings or ships or whatever, with failure in mind, meaning that the building, let's just talk about the Twin Towers, the buildings have a limit to their strength. When the buildings were being designed, it was somebody thought, well, what if an airplane accidentally crashes into our building? Is it going to be safe? Is it going to stand that? So they actually did do some studies with an airplane crash. But at the time, the largest airplane was a Boeing 707, I believe, which was smaller than the planes that actually did crash in 2001. So every Every engineered system does have a limit. It has a breaking point, if you will. And the idea is, of course, to design the system so that that breaking point is never reached. The engineer who explained that the building was designed to have a fire that would last for a certain amount of time, the assumption would have been there that firefighters would have been able to extinguish the fire. There have been fires in skyscrapers that have been put out in time so that the building did not collapse, the World Trade Center towers did.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the newest building they just put up? Do you know anything about that one in terms of its engineering? Have they corrected, if they could have, corrected some of the problems with the first towers?
You mean the new one that's going up in lower Manhattan?
Yeah. Right.
Well, one of the things they're concerned about there, for example, is that a big truck full of explosives would be too close to the building at its base and cause it to collapse due to an explosion there.
Mm-hmm.
So the first, I think, 20 stories or so of that new building are designed almost like a bunker of concrete, no windows, so that this kind of failure event, initiation event, if you will, this large explosion, will be able to be absorbed. So, yes, there certainly is a consciousness of what did happen. Everybody knows what happened to the World Trade Center towers. And this replacement of sorts, you certainly don't want that to be repeated.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll go on to Belgium for another caller here. Line number four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to address your attention to something slightly different but still in the same vein. We have technology now, cell phones, texting, emailing, all this sort of stuff that is a new relatively new technology that is advancing in many different ways. And what I'm going to talk to you about this, about the failure, is what is the consequence of the social failures that may come with this? We already know that a lot of people have a lot more accidents when you talk on a cell phone and try to drive. People don't pay attention and walk into buses or buses run into them, which has happened on the campus there. There's many problems with this new technology. It's not exactly a failure of the technology, but it's a failure of the user. Would you like to discuss that?
Well, yes, that's a very good point. Every piece of technology, whether it's a large piece or a small piece, is really embedded in our society, in our culture. And how it's used is obviously very, very important. There are some people, quite frankly, and some companies who just want to sell their product and, not even assume the responsibility that it might be harmful in ways you've described. In the ideal world, in the ideal society, this would not happen. Everybody involved with the design and with marketing and with sales and so forth would say exactly what you observe, that this new piece of technology, a cell phone, let's just take that for concreteness, really can be misused, if you will, and have the user distracted and not be as alert as normally one should be when, say, walking across the street, something so simple as that. As one of the earlier callers observed, no new technology really becomes introduced without some failures, without some things going wrong, sometimes because those things are not anticipated, not thought of. Other times they are thought of, they're just ignored. In the case of the cell phone, I think we're beginning to see a lot of reaction to the problems, precisely the problems you've pointed out. And I think we're beginning to see increasing talk about legislation to make it a crime of some kind, let's say, to use a cell phone while driving. And eventually we might even see the technology controlling this itself. A cell phone might not work, for example, if it's moving at greater than, say, 10 miles per hour. That kind of thing might be possible. This phenomenon has happened in the past when the self-opening beverage can, the pull-top can, was first introduced back in the 1960s. The pull-top actually came off, and it created a great environmental problem because it was discarded, especially at beaches. People were stepping on them and cutting themselves, and fish were swallowing these things when they were thrown in the water. Their legislation threatened to ban the self-opening can, the pop-top can, precisely because of these reasons. So the pop-top cans we have today, we all know, you don't take that tab off. It stays put. Well, that was a design, a new design, a redesign, if you will, that was introduced in direct response to the problems that were being experienced by the original design. So I think cell phones will move in that direction. I think we'll see that in the coming decade, let's say.
If I might continue slightly, sir. Number one, if you ever watch a police officer going down the street, every one of them are talking on cell phones. So making it illegal, you're going to have to start with them. But to step on what I really meant you to really discuss a little bit more is the strong social changes that are going on with texting and Twittering and cell phone usage, and where you no longer pay attention to your social situation. You'll be watching a movie and somebody rings you, or we do things that are very rude, very changing our society dramatically with this technology. And that's more on, our social changes are changing greatly is what I'm trying to get at.
Yes, well, I appreciate that. There's a lot of call for innovation these days. Innovation implies precisely a change in the way that society uses a technology. And we're not going to have innovation without these, we could call them disruptive changes, if you will. The human users, the human society is going to have to solve this problem in somehow. And it's a very difficult problem to solve because so many different people and points of view are involved. I totally agree with you. But what you're describing is not new or unique to cell phone usage. When email first came in, that same kinds of complaints were put forth. When the telephone came in, similar complaints were put forth that, the phone rings and everybody stops what they're doing. So these are age-old problems having to do with technology and society, and they're not easy problems to solve because they seem to be part of the nature of innovation.
Well, to take that further, just a little bit further, so we have these complex, sometimes complex machines or large constructions that humans make and humans use, and they require maintenance. And then there are established sets of rules about how they're to be used. And how many cases do we have really significant failures that are the result of either inadequate maintenance or they're human errors because people are not following the rules that they're supposed to be following when they're using these things?
Well, that happens quite often. In fact, that's one of the reasons I called the book To Forgive Design, because it's not the design, it's the way the design is maintained or handled or used or watched by human beings. And I talk at length about this problem in the collapse of some bridges, in particular the Minneapolis Bridge that collapsed in 2007. It was a 40-year-old bridge. The design had some features that, had it been done over again, would probably not have remained. But nevertheless, the bridge did stand safely for 40 years. It was being misused and misdiagnosed, if you will, when it collapsed. There were warning signs that it had weaknesses that should have been addressed, but these warning signs were ignored, as they so often are in so many of these cases.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Henry Petrosky. He's professor of civil engineering and of history at Duke University. This particular question why things fail is something that interests him a lot, and he's done a lot of writing about it, including his most recent book, which is titled To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure. Harvard University Press is the publisher. We have a couple of other callers here. We will get them in and go next to Champagne and line number two. Hello.
Yes, thank you very much for taking this call. I have a question that hopefully you can disabuse me of some information that I had some years ago from a friend of mine who was a European-trained highway engineer who had come to the United States and gotten his various licenses and was working on highway design here in the United States. And I posed to him a simple question one time about how many cars a highway is actually designed to last. And his comment back to me was, cars are absolutely immaterial to highway design. They just don't count. But the only thing that will wear out a highway is trucks and weather. And I said, well, how come that they don't build them stronger? And he said, well, they do in Europe. They build them much stronger, and they last nearly indefinitely in Europe. But you have to understand, here in the United States, it's a highly political process, and the building of highways is as much designed to provide maintenance as it is to provide permanent construction. And that if the European governments were in charge of building highways in this country, they would build them to last, and we simply don't. Is there anything you could comment on that could give me a little comfort? Thank you.
Well, I don't know if I can give you comfort, because I think he's basically correct. There is quite a difference between the European approach and the American approach to designing and maintaining infrastructure. That's not to say, however, that there have not been problems in Europe with failures. These have occurred too. So any statement like you've related has such complexity to it that the answer is not totally simple. But on a very high level, yes, he's basically correct.
All right. Well, again, let's go to line number one, and this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes.
I was wanting to know if in your book, if you looked at any of the recent airline disasters. I'm thinking particularly of the Air France disaster back in 2009. It seems there were system failures there, but also maybe some pilot error. But I'm wondering, are we seeing perhaps more system failures in that particular area of technology?
I think the pilot failures are more important right now. If you look at the safety record of commercial airlines, it's really quite astounding. I do consider some airline accidents. The one that happened on approach to Buffalo a few years ago in particular, and I talk about how that was at first called a design problem, when it proved to be, in fact, exactly pilot error and pilot inappropriate pilot reaction to the situation. So yes, airplane accidents are very much a part of all this, and the lessons learned from them are extremely important. One of the reasons the aircraft industry, the airline industry, has been so successful in having a wonderful safety record is that they take irregularities, warning signs, very seriously.
Yeah, well, when you say inappropriate pilot reaction, isn't that a design problem or potentially a systems problem?
Yes, it could be. It's a matter of definition. Ultimately, you could say everything's a design problem if, you know, the designer doesn't anticipate what the pilot could do. But obviously, there has to be a limit to this. We have to assume the pilot is rational. We have to assume that the vast majority of pilots will do the right thing in the right under the right circumstances. But there is a whole branch of engineering that interfaces with psychology. It's sometimes called human factors or ergonomics, that has to do with how the machine and the human interface. And yes, it should be anticipated. But in this case, the Buffalo accident in particular, the pilot really was way out of line, way out of order. And it's hard to imagine that we should have to design something to accommodate a pilot with that much incompetence.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, again, other questions, welcome. We do have a couple of minutes left. There are a lot of bridge stories in this book, and I think that apparently bridges somehow by their nature make really good case studies. Is that right?
Well, that's right. I like bridges in part because they're pure engineering. They're not, you know, covered with a facade the way skyscrapers are. That puts them in the architecture realm. So bridges to me are almost paragons or paradigms for all of designed systems. Mm. I might say, by the way, that in the book, I don't just talk about these accidents and failures of the kind we've been talking about, but I, since we are talking on a radio show that originates in Urbana, I would say that I have a whole chapter about when I was a graduate student at the University of Illinois and how I really began to think about failure, because the centerpiece of the building I was in, which was Talbot Laboratory, was a giant testing machine. And the whole purpose of that testing machine was to observe failure, to pull pieces of steel apart or crush pieces of concrete until they failed. Mm-hmm. And I emphasize this because this got me thinking about how significant failure is, not only as a phenomenon, but also as a concept that provides a unified way of thinking about engineering. Yeah. So I owe it to Urbana-Champaign for a lot of what I think about today.
Well, I'm sure if there are anybody in the engineering program here who's listening in, they would be grateful for the tip of the hat. Well, I also think about to bring all that together, and maybe just one of the many stories in the book is this story about the Brooklyn Bridge and about how the people that were building it were really unhappy with the quality of the wire that they were getting, that was being made into these gigantic cables that hold up the bridge. And so they were rejecting some of this wire, and then they found out that it was just coming right back at them. So in a way, to deal with that problem, I think, that the company who was doing it effectively over-designed. To try to make it even more robust than perhaps they would have otherwise, which makes you wonder that it's difficult if cost is an issue, and of course you can't reduce your possibility of failure to zero, but how much design can, if indeed you over-design, how close to zero you can get your failure rate?
Well, if you over-design terribly, you can pretty much reduce the failure rate to zero, at least due to structural failure. Mm. The fact is that when things are over-designed, let's just talk concretely again about bridges, then the tendency is for people building subsequent bridges to say, well, you know, we're building a bridge just like that one, but it was over-designed. It doesn't have to be that strong. It doesn't have to be that expensive. Let's make it a little less strong and a little less expensive. And if that succeeds too, then obviously the trend is to pare it down, that type of bridge, until a failure occurs. And this is documented throughout history. That's one of the other reasons I like to write about bridges, because there's a long history of bridges and bridge failures, really going back to Roman times.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was thinking. Originally, I was thinking of, we have this long history of building bridges, and you would think that by now you would have learned everything that can possibly go wrong so that you would be able to build a bridge that would not collapse. But then, of course, your response was, well, but we keep pushing. We keep pushing it. They keep building bigger bridges and longer bridges and using new materials. So it's not a static kind of thing.
Well, that's right. And there's one other point that perhaps I should mention, and that is that these lessons that have been learned back centuries or even millennia, they're not always remembered. We tend to think, well, you know, what happened with the Romans? We know so much more than they did. The lessons they learned are not relevant to today. Or the lessons from the Renaissance when bridges were collapsing. That's not appropriate for thinking in terms of a computer generation. Well, that's short-sightedness, I believe, because we can't really anticipate something going wrong unless we remember that it did go wrong in a previous example.
Mm. Well, we're just about at the point that we're going to have to stop. Any last sort of idea that you might like to leave with folks?
Well, this idea that the human factor is a big part of design, first of all, and then of maintenance and repair and conservation of the infrastructure that we're talking about, because all of this is really part of infrastructure in a big way. Because the human factor is always involved, we have to understand that everything is ultimately very, very much potentially flawed. And we have to be vigilant. We have to be critical. When we look at a design as an engineer, we have to approach it with an idea that, well, there very likely is a mistake in this. And I don't want to just go rubber stamp it, that I'm confident that because it was designed on a computer, let's say, it's going to work.
All right. Our guest this morning, Henry Petrosky. He's professor of civil engineering and of history at Duke University. His new book is To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure, published by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. He's talking with us this morning from Duke. We also want to say thanks to the engineer at the other end of this high-quality connection, Kennard Blake, for making it sound so good. And to you, Professor Petrosky, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 64 years. Hendrick House works to ensure a quiet environment for study and relaxation. More information is available at 365-8000 or at hendrickhouse.com.
It's 11:56 and you're listening to WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Coming up next week on Focus, on Monday, we'll have a couple of shows from our archives dealing with baseball. On Monday's 10 o'clock program, we'll hear from Bill Dixon, freelance award-winning writer and author of Bill Veeck, Baseball's Greatest Maverick. We'll explore the life and times of one of baseball's most eccentric personalities, Bill Veeck. Many may remember him for the wacky things that he did to get people to the ballpark. As one-time owner of the White Sox, had a serious impact on the game, introducing innovations that we now take for granted. Then in the 11 o'clock hour of the program, we'll hear an encore broadcast of a conversation from July of 2011 with Doug Glanville, former professional baseball player with the Philadelphia Phillies, the Chicago Cubs, and the Texas Rangers. In his 2010 book, the former outfielder provides a human side of baseball, discussing issues many fans may not think of, among them leaving family when it's time for spring training, being traded, prolonged losing streaks, suffering through an injury, and dealing with different player personalities in the clubhouse. So a couple of stories about baseball, which makes sense. We're going into the All-Star break, and so if you're suffering from any Major League Baseball withdrawal on that Monday, we got you covered on Focus. On Tuesday's show, we will talk with Stephen Kotler, award-winning science writer and author of Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. It's a book that argues that the world is getting better at a rapid rate. In this book, the author argues that over the past 50 years, global standards of living have tripled. The food supply has increased and rates of literacy and life expectancy have grown. So overall, we're living in a better world. And the book looks at the forces responsible. That's a conversation from May of this year. In the 11 o'clock hour, we'll hear an encore broadcast of David Inge's conversation with award-winning journalist Belva Davis from April of this year. She'll talk about her book, Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. Those are the stories, that the conversations that we have ahead over the next couple of days on Focus. Thank you. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. There's